Welcome back to Office Hours. I'm Sarah.
And I'm Kiffer. Today we're working through Lesson 12, Integrated Appraisal of Epidemiological Research. This is the capstone of this course, so this is the last episode of the season.
And the framing of the lesson is genuinely satisfying. The first 11 lessons built up a working toolkit one layer at a time. Lesson 1 gave us the historical, philosophical, and ethical foundations of the discipline. Lesson 2 walked through systematic reviews and evidence synthesis. Lessons 3 through 6 covered the 4 observational designs. Lesson 7 gave us the conceptual foundations of measurement and causal specification. And lessons 8 through 11 gave us the full inventory of biases, selection, information, design specific, and confounding.
And lesson 12 is where the toolkit becomes a method, where reading a paper stops being something you do impressionistically and becomes a structured procedure.
3 content sections. Walk me through the architecture before we dive in.
Section 1 frames reading studies as inferential chains, the 7 decisions every paper makes, plus the 3 reporting frameworks that audit them. Section 2 converts that conceptual material into a 5-stage stepwise appraisal procedure with a worked example. And section 3 adds 2 complementary tools, pattern recognition for warning signs, and a procedure for synthesizing evidence when multiple studies disagree.
Okay, let's start with section 1. The core principle is laid out almost as a slogan.
Right. A study's conclusions are only as strong as the weakest link in its inferential chain. That's the operating principle of the entire lesson. Critical appraisal means systematically examining every link, from the research question through to interpretation, to determine where the chain might break.
And reading a study is not a passive act of absorbing conclusions. It's an active process of evaluating a chain of inferential decisions. Every published study represents a series of choices, each of which can introduce error, bias, or uncertainty. Your task as a critical reader is to identify those choices and assess whether they support the conclusions.
Then the lesson lays out 7 decisions every paper makes in order. First, the research question. Second, the target population. Third, the causal model. Fourth, the study design. Fifth, the measurement strategy. Sixth, the analytic approach. And seventh, the interpretation.
Slow down for a second. Why does the order matter?
Because each step constrains the next. A vague research question makes every subsequent decision difficult to evaluate. If you don't know precisely what exposure is being studied, you can't tell whether the population that was sampled was the right one. A misspecified causal model can ruin even a well-executed analysis. If you didn't think carefully about confounders, mediators, and colliders before you collected data, your statistical adjustments might make things worse rather than better.
So the chain isn't just a list of 7 things to check. It's a sequence where errors propagate forward.
Exactly. And that's why the reading procedure works in order. You don't start at the results table. You start at the question.
Okay, then the lesson revisits the 3 reporting frameworks we previewed back in lessons 1 and 2. Strobe, Consort, and Prisma, the 3 audit schemas for the inferential chain.
And the trick is that each one is matched to a different family of study designs, so you pick the framework that fits the paper in front of you. Let me walk through them one by one.
Please, and spell out the acronyms because they're a mouthful.
First, STROPE, that stands for Strengthening the Reporting of Observational Studies in Epidemiology. It's the checklist for cohort studies, case control studies, and cross-sectional studies. The 3 big observational designs we covered in lessons 3 through 6, key items include clear specification of the design in the title or abstract, description of eligibility criteria and methods of participant selection, definitions of exposures, outcomes, and confounders with their measurement methods, and explanation of how study size was determined, statistical methods, including confounding control, the flow of participants through each stage of the study, summary measures with confidence intervals, and an explicit discussion of bias and limitations.
Second, CONSORT. That stands for Consolidated Standards of Reporting Trials. It's the gold standard for randomized controlled trials, the experimental designs we touched on briefly. CONSORT requires everything STROBE does, but adds requirements specific to randomization. Trial design, including whether it's parallel, factorial, or crossover. The allocation ratio, the method of random sequence generation. Allocation concealment, meaning whether the people enrolling participants could know in advance which group the next participant would land in. blinding details, intervention details for each arm of the trial sufficient for replication, pre-specified primary and secondary outcomes, sample size calculation, including any interim analyses or stopping rules, and the consort flow diagram showing enrollment, allocation, follow-up, and analysis at each stage.
And third, PRISMA. That stands for Preferred Reporting Items for Systematic Reviews and Meta-Analyses. It's the guide for evidence synthesis, the kind of paper that pools many studies. PRISMA requires a structured research question, often using the PICO format, which stands for Population Intervention Comparator Outcome. Then protocol registration, often in a registry called PROSPERO, a complete and reproducible search strategy for at least one database. The study selection process with explicit inclusion and exclusion criteria, data extraction methods, and risk of bias assessment tools. The PRISMA flow diagram showing identification, screening, eligibility, and inclusion of studies. Synthesis methods, and an assessment of the certainty of evidence using something like GRADE.
And spell out GRADE too while we're naming things.
GRADE stands for Grading of Recommendations, Assessment, Development, and Evaluations. It's a structured framework for rating how confident you should be in a body of evidence. It considers things like risk of bias, inconsistency across studies, indirectness, imprecision, and publication bias. The output is usually a four-level rating: high, moderate, low, or very low certainty.
So the three frameworks together cover the universe of empirical study types: STROBE for observational, CONSORT for trials, PRISMA for systematic reviews.
Right, and the lesson is really sharp on a distinction that matters here: reporting quality versus methodological quality.
Okay, walk me through that, because at first glance they sound like the same thing.
They're not. A poorly designed study can be well reported. A well-designed study can be poorly reported. Reporting quality enables evaluation. It does not guarantee validity.
Let me try an example. Imagine a cross-sectional study with a convenience sample of 200 undergraduates. Single item exposure measure, single item outcome measure, no confounding control. That study can fully comply with the STROBE checklist. It can describe in detail exactly how it sampled, exactly how it measured, exactly what statistical model it used. STROBE compliance just means it told you what it did. It doesn't mean what it did was any good.
Exactly, and the meta research backs this up. Adherence to reporting guidelines is associated with more complete reporting, but not necessarily lower bias or better design. You need complete reporting to judge a study, but completeness alone does not make a study trustworthy.
So the frameworks are necessary but not sufficient.
Right? They tell you where to look in the paper. They don't tell you whether what you find is any good. That's the methodological appraisal you have to do yourself.
Okay, let's move into section two. The five-stage stepwise appraisal procedure. This is where the conceptual scaffolding turns into a working method.
Right. Critical appraisal is most effective when conducted systematically. Rather than reading a study and forming a vague impression, you work through five distinct stages, each targeting a specific aspect of inferential quality, and each stage maps onto material from earlier lessons in the course.
Stage one, question clarity and plausibility.
Before evaluating any methods, you assess the question itself. Four checks. Is the exposure well-defined and measurable? Could it be operationalized differently in a way that would change the answer? Is the outcome specific and clinically or epidemiologically meaningful? Is the target population clearly identified? And does the proposed relationship have biological or social plausibility, or is it being tested without prior reason?
And the principle here is that a well-specified question constrains everything downstream. The design, the measurement strategy, the analytic approach. If the question is vague, every subsequent decision becomes hard to evaluate.
Stage two, design alignment. Does the study design appropriately address the research question?
And this is where the design taxonomy from lessons 4 through 7 pays off. Different questions need different designs. A question about causation is best addressed by a randomized controlled trial, or when experiments are infeasible, a well-designed cohort study with strong confounding control. A question about prevalence calls for a cross-sectional design with probability sampling. A question about a rare outcome is efficiently addressed by a case control study, because you can sample on outcome status, and a question requiring evidence synthesis calls for a systematic review or meta-analysis.
And the question to ask is, would an alternative design have provided stronger evidence with fewer threats to validity? Design misalignment doesn't necessarily invalidate a study, but it limits the strength of conclusions that can be drawn from it.
Stage 3, internal validity, bias identification. The lesson calls this the most detailed stage. It's where everything from lessons 8 through 11 comes back.
Yeah, this is the heart of the appraisal, and you systematically work through three categories of bias: selection processes, measurement error, and confounding control.
Selection processes first. From lesson 8, was sampling representative, or could selection bias have distorted results? Could collider bias have been introduced by conditioning on a common effect, like restricting the analysis to hospitalized patients or adjusting for a variable that's an effect of both the exposure and the outcome? Was there differential loss to follow up or differential non-response that might have produced a biased remaining sample?
Measurement error second. From lesson 9, could differential misclassification have biased results, where the error is correlated with exposure or outcome status? Could non-differential misclassification have attenuated a true effect, dragging it toward the null? Were validated instruments used? And critically, were they validated in the study population, not just in some other population where the psychometrics might not transfer?
Confounding control third, from lesson 11. Were confounders identified using a causal model, like a directed acyclic graph, which I'll spell out as a DAG, or were they chosen based on statistical significance, which is a fishing expedition rather than principled selection? Could unmeasured or residual confounding remain? Were specification errors present, like adjusting for a mediator on the causal pathway, adjusting for a collider downstream of both exposure and outcome, or assuming a linear relationship that's actually nonlinear?
And the lesson includes a great empirical example of why this stage matters: the Women's Health Initiative.
Walk me through that one.
So in the 1990s, observational studies of postmenopausal women suggested that hormone replacement therapy reduced cardiovascular disease risk. Then the Women's Health Initiative randomized trial, which started in the early 90s, and reported results in 2002, found the opposite. Hormone therapy slightly increased cardiovascular risk. The contradiction was huge.
And what happened when researchers reanalyzed the observational data?
They reanalyzed the observational data using the same eligibility criteria and timing conventions as the trial, restricting to women near the start of menopause, requiring the exposure to begin during a defined window, applying the same outcome ascertainment rules. And the observational estimate shifted substantially. A lot of the original observational benefit was driven by selection processes and analytic choices, not by a real protective biological effect. So selection and timing decisions can drive results just as much as the underlying biology.
That's a dramatic illustration of stage 3's importance. Okay, stage 4, statistical inference.
Even with good design and minimal bias, statistical inference can go wrong. 5 subchecks, model assumptions. Are distributional assumptions justified? Is the sample large enough for the asymptotic methods being used to apply?
Uncertainty quantification. Are confidence intervals reported, not just p-values? Are they appropriately interpreted, or is the paper conflating statistical significance with clinical importance?
Multiple testing. Were multiple comparisons made without correction? Were subgroup analyses pre-specified or post hoc? With 20 subgroup analyses at alpha equal to 0.05, the probability of finding at least one statistically significant result by chance alone is over 60%. So a single significant subgroup finding for many post-hoc tests is essentially uninformative.
Model selection. Were many models fit and only the best reported? Could selective reporting inflate false positive rates? This is the p-hacking problem from lesson 1, returning at the appraisal stage.
And fifth, effect sizes over significance. Does the study emphasize the magnitude and precision of effects, or does it reduce everything to p less than 0.05? Versus p greater than or equal to 0.05. A study that reports a hazard ratio of 1.02 with a narrow confidence interval has detected a precisely estimated trivial effect. Statistical significance is not the same as clinical or public health significance.
And then stage 5, external validity and transportability. We covered this in detail in lesson 8, so we'll move quickly.
Right. Sample representativeness. Does the study sample represent the target population? Highly selected samples, like patients at academic medical centers or volunteer cohorts, may not. Contextual differences. Results from one healthcare system may not transport to another. Social determinants, cultural factors, healthcare access all differ across settings. Effect modification. If the exposure-outcome relationship varies across subgroups, transporting an average effect to a population with a different subgroup distribution could mislead. And temporal validity, medical practice and population characteristics change over time. Results from the 1990s may not apply today.
And the punchline of stage 5 is that external validity is not simply about sample size. A large but highly selected sample may have less external validity than a smaller but representative one.
Okay, the lesson then works through a complete worked example applying all 5 stages to a single study. Let's do it carefully because it brings everything together.
Set the scene.
The study is a retrospective cohort study from the early COVID-19 era. COVID-19, which I'll spell out as coronavirus disease 2019, was the global pandemic that began in late 2019 and dominated public health research for several years. The study reports that patients with low serum vitamin D levels at hospital admission had 2.5 times the odds of intensive care unit admission compared to those with sufficient vitamin D levels. I'll spell out ICU as intensive care unit. The odds ratio of 2.5 had a 95% confidence interval from 1.4 to 4.5. Adjusted for age, sex, and body mass index, I'll spell out BMI as body mass index, the standard measure of weight relative to height squared.
Stage 1, question clarity.
Reasonably clear, the exposure is vitamin D level, the outcome is ICU admission, the population is hospitalized COVID-19 patients.
Stage 2, design alignment.
Retrospective cohort using hospital records. Appropriate for this question, given that you can't ethically randomize people to vitamin D deficiency, but it has the inherent limitations of retrospective designs and hospital-based sampling.
Stage 3, internal validity. This is where the appraisal really starts to bite.
Major concerns, first, collider bias. The study restricts to hospitalized patients. Hospitalization is itself caused by both vitamin D status and other factors that affect ICU risk. So conditioning on hospitalization conditions on a collider. It can create or distort the apparent association between vitamin D and ICU admission, even if no causal relationship exists in the broader population.
Second concern.
Confounding by illness severity. Sicker patients may have lower vitamin D for reasons that have nothing to do with baseline deficiency. Acute inflammation lowers measured vitamin D in the blood through what's called an acute phase response. So we can't tell whether low vitamin D drove severity or whether severity drove low vitamin D readings. The temporal direction is genuinely ambiguous.
Third concern.
Measurement timing. Vitamin D was measured at admission, not pre-illness. So we don't know what these patients' long-term vitamin D status looked like. We have a single biomarker reading taken in the middle of an acute illness. That's a fragile basis for a claim about chronic deficiency.
Stage 4, statistical inference.
Adjusted for only 3 confounders, age, sex, and body mass index, almost certainly residual confounding from variables like smoking status, diabetes, kidney disease, immobility, socioeconomic status, comorbidity burden, none of which are in the model. No sensitivity analyses reported. So we don't know how robust the result is to violation of assumptions.
Stage 5, external validity.
Single hospital study, limited generalizability. The hospitalized population doesn't represent all COVID-19 patients, and a single institution may have idiosyncratic protocols, patient demographics, and practice patterns that don't transfer.
And the conclusion?
Despite a statistically significant and seemingly large effect, the inferential chain has several weak links, particularly collider bias and reverse causation, that undermines causal interpretation. The data may be real and the analysis may be technically correct, but the design doesn't support the strong causal conclusion the abstract makes. The chain breaks at stage 3.
And that's how the 5-stage procedure produces a calibrated judgment, not blanket dismissal, not uncritical acceptance, a specific account of where the inference is strong and where it's weak.
Right, okay. Section 3, red flags, quality indicators, and applied synthesis. Section 2 gave you a step-by-step procedure for working through a single paper. Section 3 adds 2 complementary tools.
Pattern recognition for warning signs that cut across study types.
And a procedure for synthesizing evidence when multiple studies disagree.
6 red flags that warrant heightened scrutiny. Walk me through them.
First, implausible effect sizes. An odds ratio of 8 from a cross-sectional study of a common exposure and a common outcome almost certainly reflects bias rather than biology. Most true causal effects in observational research are modest. Odds ratios in the range of 1.1 to 2.0 are typical. Effect sizes of 5 or greater are unusual outside of strong specific exposures like asbestos and mesothelioma or smoking and lung cancer.
Second, inconsistent sample sizes, numbers in tables that don't add up to the totals reported elsewhere in the paper. Different denominators for different analyses without explanation. These suggest sloppy reporting at best, and at worst, fabrication or data manipulation. The kind of arithmetic check you can do with a calculator can sometimes catch surprisingly serious problems.
Third, lack of transparency. No flow diagram showing how participants moved through the study, no description of how key variables were measured, no discussion of bias. The absence of standard reporting elements is itself informative. If a paper reads as though the authors are hiding the methods, you should assume there's something worth hiding.
Fourth, post hoc subgroup analyses, reporting one significant interaction out of 15 tests, none of which were pre-specified, with multiple testing, single significant results from large numbers of post hoc analyses are effectively uninformative. They're hypothesis generating at best and require independent replication before they should change practice.
Fifth, mediator adjustment, adjusting for a variable that's on the causal pathway from exposure to outcome, like adjusting for blood pressure when estimating the effect of sodium intake on stroke. Sodium causes elevated blood pressure, which causes stroke. So blood pressure is a mediator. Adjusting for it removes part of the causal effect you're trying to measure, biasing the estimate toward the null. And if blood pressure shares unmeasured common causes with stroke, you can also introduce collider stratification bias.
Sixth, the interpretive overreach. A cross-sectional study claiming an exposure causes an outcome. Cross-sectional designs cannot establish temporal ordering, so reverse causation is equally consistent with the data. The verb is doing more work than the data support. Appropriate language is associated with, not causes.
Then on the positive side, the lesson lays out 6 quality indicators, features that increase confidence in a paper.
First, explicit DAGs or causal diagrams. They show the investigators have thought carefully about causal structure, including which variables are confounders versus mediators versus colliders, before they touched the data. That's the principled alternative to data-driven variable selection.
Second, transparent and complete reporting following STROBE, CONSORT, or PRISMA, including flow diagrams. Reporting all pre-specified analyses, including null results, including everything that didn't work, not just the analyses that produced the headline finding.
Third, validated measurement instruments indicates the exposure and outcome were measured using tools with established reliability and validity in the study population, not just in some other population where the psychometrics might not transfer.
Fourth, analytic strategy aligned with design. Statistical methods appropriate for the data structure, survival analysis for time-to-event data, multi-level models for clustered data, generalized estimating equations for repeated measures, the right tool for the right shape of data.
Fifth, sensitivity and bias analyses, tests of how robust the results are to alternative assumptions, E-values for unmeasured confounding, which we'll come back to in a second, quantitative bias analysis for misclassification, multiple imputation for missing data with explicit assumptions about the missingness mechanism.
And sixth, open science practices, pre-registration where the analysis plan is filed publicly before data collection, data sharing so other researchers can independently verify findings, open access code, registered reports where peer review happens before results are known. All of these reduce opportunities for selective reporting and increase the credibility of findings.
Quick aside, what's an E-value since you mentioned it?
An E-value quantifies the minimum strength of association that an unmeasured confounder would need to have with both the exposure and the outcome beyond the measured confounders to fully explain away the observed association. A larger E-value means the result is more robust to unmeasured confounding. It's a quantitative answer to the question, how big a confounder am I missing for this finding to disappear?
Got it. Okay, then the lesson moves into applied synthesis, the two studies on screen time and adolescent mental health. This is the worked example for section three.
Right. Two hypothetical studies that reach different conclusions about the same question. The exercise is to compare them not just on their results, but on their methodological rigor.
Study A cross-sectional design, 50,000 participants from a convenience sample recruited via an online platform. Single question screen time measure, just asking how many hours per day do you use screens? Single item mood rating, adjusted for age and sex only. Reports a correlation of 0.35 with a p-value less than 0.001 and a title declaring a strong link.
Study B, prospective cohort. 3,200 participants from a probability sample, the kind of design we covered in Lesson 8, validated time use diary collected at three time points across the follow-up period, the PHQA as the depression measure. PHQA stands for Patient Health Questionnaire for Adolescents. It's a validated screening instrument for depression in adolescents, well-studied for reliability and validity, adjusted for age, sex, socioeconomic status, parental mental health, physical activity, sleep, and prior depression. So a much more comprehensive confounding strategy. Reports a beta coefficient of 0.04 with a 95% confidence interval from negative 0.02 to 0.10 and a conclusion of minimal association.
So study A says strong link, study B says minimal association. Which one wins the synthesis?
If you stop at the headlines, study A looks more impressive, bigger sample, larger effect, lower p-value. But the synthesis question is which one has the stronger methodology? And study B wins almost every dimension that matters.
Walk through it.
Design, cross-sectional versus prospective cohort. The cohort can establish temporal ordering. The cross-sectional study cannot. Sampling. Convenience versus probability sample. The probability sample supports population generalization. The convenience sample does not. Measurement, single question versus validated instrument across three time points. The validated instrument is far more reliable, and the repeated measurement reduces error. Outcome, single mood item versus the PHQA. The validated depression screener is the standard, confounding control. Two variables versus eight, including the most important ones for this question. Prior depression, parental mental health, sleep, physical activity. The cohort study has handled the obvious threats to internal validity. The cross-sectional study has not.
And the lesson concludes that a rigorous synthesis would weight study B's evidence more heavily, despite the smaller sample size and less dramatic effect size.
Right. And that's a counterintuitive result for people who have been trained to equate sample size with evidence. A smaller, well-designed study often beats a larger, weakly designed one. The integrity of the inferential chain matters more than its width.
And there's a deeper principle the lesson names here. Evidence evaluation is probabilistic, not binary.
Yeah, no single study is perfect. No single study is worthless. The goal is to synthesize across studies, weighting each by its methodological rigor, and to exercise disciplined skepticism.
And the lesson is really clear about what disciplined skepticism is not. Talk through that, because I think this is one of the most important things students take away from the course.
Disciplined skepticism is not cynicism or nihilism about research. It does not mean dismissing every study because it's just observational or because you can prove anything with statistics. That's the lazy version that uses the appearance of skepticism to avoid actually engaging with evidence. It's a kind of intellectual abdication.
Right. And it's also not the opposite, which would be uncritical acceptance of anything published in a high-impact journal.
Exactly. Disciplined skepticism means applying the specific analytical skills you have developed in this course to identify precisely where evidence is strong and where it's uncertain, and calibrating your confidence accordingly. It's a craft. It requires effort and specific knowledge, and it produces calibrated judgments, not blanket positions.
And calibrated judgments are exactly what the public discourse around health research is missing. People want certainty. They want a study to tell them yes or no. The discipline of holding probabilistic judgments based on the strength of the underlying evidence, that's the genuine contribution epidemiologists can make.
Okay, pulling the takeaways from the whole lesson.
First, read studies as inferential chains. Seven decisions in order. Research question, target population, causal model, study design, measurement, analysis, interpretation. Each one constrains the next. The research question anchors everything that follows.
Second, three reporting frameworks, STROPE for observational studies, CONSORT for randomized trials, PRISMA for systematic reviews. Reporting completeness enables evaluation, but doesn't guarantee validity. A bad study can be reported well, and a good study can be reported poorly. The frameworks tell you where to look, not what counts as good.
Third, five appraisal stages: question clarity, design alignment, internal validity, statistical inference, external validity. Work through them in order from top to bottom. Stage three, internal validity, is where most of the work happens.
Fourth, pattern recognize the red flags, implausible effect sizes, inconsistent sample numbers, lack of transparency, post hoc subgroup analyses, mediator adjustment, interpretive overreach. Six warning signs to watch for.
Fifth, recognize the quality indicators on the positive side, explicit causal diagrams, validated instruments, sensitivity analyses, open science practices, the features that distinguish careful work from sloppy work.
And sixth, synthesis weighs evidence by methodological rigor. A smaller, well-designed study often beats a larger, weakly designed one. Disciplined skepticism, calibrated confidence, not blanket dismissal or uncritical acceptance. Match your certainty to the strength of the underlying inferential chain.
And take the capstone reflection seriously when you sit down with it. It asks how your reading of epidemiological evidence has changed across this course. That working stance is what you carry forward into the rest of the series and into every health claim you encounter for the rest of your career, in the news, in academic papers, in policy debates, and in your own clinical or public health practice.
And one final note from me before we close out the season. This is the end of the course. The course is called Evaluating Epidemiological Research. And what we've done across 12 lessons is build a working capacity to read and judge studies the way a trained epidemiologist does. You've learned the history of the field. You've learned the philosophical foundations. You've learned how the published record can mislead. You've learned how systematic reviews synthesize evidence. You've learned the four observational designs. You've learned how to think about measurement and causal structure. And you've learned every major category of bias that can undermine a study. And in this final lesson, you've learned how to put it all together into a single integrated procedure.
And what comes next is a logical continuation. This course was the evaluation course. You can now read epidemiological research critically. The next course in the scaffolded series, Design and Conduct of Epidemiological Studies, asks you to do the work yourself. To design valid studies, calculate measures of disease frequency and association, work through screening and diagnostic tests, and conduct hybrid and surveillance designs. The bias inventory you built here becomes the design checklist you use there.
And after that, quantitative methods in public health brings the full statistical machinery. Linear, logistic, and survival regression, mixed models for clustered and longitudinal data, modern causal inference methods, the statistical tools that let you analyze the studies you can now design, the same R programming skills you've been practicing in the code boxes will scale up across both of those courses.
But the appraisal lens you built earlier in this series is what makes those methods worth learning. Without the capacity to read studies critically, the methods are just techniques. With it, the methods become tools for producing trustworthy knowledge about human health. That's the difference between learning epidemiology and becoming an epidemiologist.
Congratulations on finishing this course. It's a serious achievement. The discipline of holding evidence to account, calibrating confidence to methodological rigor, and refusing both cynicism and credulity, that's a public good. Carry it with you.
Thank you for spending this semester with us. It's been a privilege to walk through this material together.
Take care, everyone, and good luck.
See you earlier in this series.